Chapter 16. Shaima. Doubt begets understanding, and understanding begets compassion. Verily, it is conviction that kills. Parsis, The New Analytics. Spring 4112, Year of the Tusk, Shaima. Oily torchlight, orange faces slack with anxiety. Orange brickwork stained and smeared with offal. Hunched ceilings so low that even the shortest of the bowmen had to stoop. Men coughed, some continuously, but not because of the sewage soaking their boots. The fires above were eating the air. Or so the water-bearer had said. The Kishadam stood beneath the exit. The asps wound about his neck peered upward, their thumb-sized heads a silvery black. The idolaters had fallen silent. The vaulted ceiling no longer thrummed with impact and explosion. Grit no longer tinkled across their helms. He cocked his shaved pate as though listening.
Douse the light, he commanded. Cover your eyes.
They dropped their torches into the slop. For a moment, sputtering blue light illuminated their shins. Everything went black. Then, impossibly bright, a thunderous crack.
Move!
The water-bearer cried.
Climb! Climb!
Suddenly all was blue, illuminated by a coin of incandescence that flared on the water-bearer's brow. They jostled forward, spitting at the dust. One by one they shouldered their way past the blind man, struggled up a slope of broken and blistering stone, then found themselves dashing through fiery ruins.
This thought you hear, the old Dunyain said, is not part of the thousandfold thought.
Kellis ignored these words.
Take me to them.
To whom?
To those you hold captive.
And if I refuse?
Why would you refuse?
Because I need to revise my assumptions, to explore these unforeseen permutations. I had discounted this possibility.
What possibility?
That the wilderness would break rather than enlighten, that you would come to me a madman.
Water, endlessly dropping pounded air and stone, the thunder of inevitability.
Refuse me anything, and I will kill you, father.
Hunched low on their saddles, the Kianine raced from the ruins of the Tantana Gate to the River Jeshimal, their many-colored kalats slapping against the rings of their mail, at first just a few dozen, then hundreds, in a long arrow-shaped stream. Still others filed out the Jeshimal Gate, which lay so close to the Ainani flank. The Taidoni hornsmen, who could see the Fainim quite clearly from the shrine, sounded their alarums again and again. But the old Earl of Agansinor plodded onward at a trot. He could see the great cloud rising from the far quarters of the city, but the half-ruined arches of the Skellora Aqueduct, which was very near, obscured his view. When the horns continued to sound, he cursed and sent scouts forward. By then, it was too late. The first of the Kianine, their horses lathered by the sprint, had reached the Jeshimal. They began to secure the crossings. For the hornsmen watching from the shrine of Azoria, it seemed that Shaima had been tipped so that war itself might spill from it. Soon, numbers that dwarfed the Taidoni reserves were racing across the Sherazor. Several of the mastodons, which had been the first to cross the toppled wall, were now tramping in their wake, dragging the same timber rafts that had been used to bridge the low ridge of debris. And the hornsmen saw it with far more clarity than any could. The cunning of the Padiraja's plan. By now, Earl Gothyelk had urged his knights into a ranging gallop, leaving his more numerous footmen behind. As he picked his way past the aqueduct, he saw his dilemma immediately, for hundreds of heathen had already crossed the river and were forming up over the raised fields and groves. Raising his mace high, he called his kinsmen to formation. When he saw that his peers, the Earls Iyengar, Damergal, and Werigin Greatheart, had also cleared the ruined aqueduct, he cried out and charged headlong toward the seething banks of the River Jeshimal. Raising a mighty shout, the thanes and knights of Setadon followed, In absolute darkness they walked through halls more ancient than the Tusk, a father leading his son. The roar of the waterfall receded, became a wash as featureless as the black. The scuff of their steps echoed across walls as pitted with representation as those that had come before. And Kellis talked, explained all that inference had taught him of his father. He spoke in generalities mostly. The details he hazarded, particularly with regard to Moengus's manipulation of Neyur, he secured through the assignation of probabilities. After fleeing the Utamot, you turned south rather than east. You knew the same Swazond that would see you survive the steppe would also see you dead in the Nansorium. This was how you found yourself in Fainim lands. They imprisoned you at first, for though their hatred fell short of the Nansor's homicidal fury, the Battle of Zerkerta had not yet happened. They had no love of the Skilvendi. After learning their language, you professed your devotion to Fain. Because of your literacy, it was easy to convince your captors to sell you as a slave. You fetched a respectable price. Not long after, you were freed, for the love you instilled in your masters quickly became awe. Not even the Fainic priests could match your command of the Palais Afan, or any of the other subsidiary scriptures you were able to obtain. Those who would whip you now implored you to travel to Shaima, to the Kishorim, and the possibility of power beyond anything the Dunyain had conceived. 5 steps. Kellis could smell the water drying across his father's bare skin. My inference was warranted, Moengus said from the black before him. Indeed, we dwarf the world-born. They are less than children to us. No matter what we encounter, be it their philosophy, their medicine, their poetry, or even their faith, we see so much deeper, and our strength is that much greater. So you assumed taking up the water would be no different, that becoming one of the Indara Kishori would make you godlike in comparison. And since the Kishorim themselves scarcely understood the metaphysics of their practice, there was nothing you could learn that would contradict this assumption. You couldn't know that the Sukkah was a metaphysic of the heart, not the intellect, of passion. So you let them blind you, only to find your powers proportionate to your vestigial passions. What you thought to be the shortest path was, in fact, a dead end. The air shivered to the rhythm of hammering drums. High above the wreckage of street and structure, those scarlet schoolmen designated watchers waited, standing upon the ground's echo in the sky. Plumes towered between them, firestorms raged beneath their slippered feet, the black clouds wheeled above. Only with difficulty could they see the cadres of their brothers spread across forward limits of the tossed and broken landscape. They sensed the Koray before they saw the first of the Thesgi bowmen, absences like wraiths weaving across the shattered ground below. Shouts of warning were traded, but no one knew what to do. Not since the Scholastic Wars had the Scarlet Spires waged such a battle. There was a flash, white-ringed with a nacre of black. One of their number, Ryman, plummeted to ground where he shattered salt. The others ran across sky. Dismayed shouts drew Eleazarus's attention to the cloudscape behind him. He saw gouts of flame falling from the hanging heights, roaring across already scorched ground. He glanced about, saw the fright and bewilderment of his people. But for some reason, his own terror was nowhere to be found. Instead, hot tears burned down his cheeks. Great and intangible weights fell away, so quickly he thought he might pop into the sky, like a bladder of air released from drowning waters. It happened. It happened. He looked up to the heights looming before them, to the gilded dome of the Tesseract, the Kishorim Tabernacle, wavering in the heat of the intervening fires. Then he swept his gaze to either flank, to the burning buildings that ringed the arena they had created. They were all around him, as they had always been, Kishorim filth, surrounding, surrounding.
They come! He boomed in a laughing, sorcerous voice. At long last, they come!
Arrayed across the pitched ruin, so small beneath the fires they had kindled, the schoolmen of the Scarlet Spires cried out in exultant acclaim. Their Grand Master had come back to them. Then threads of incandescence, blinding blue and white, lashed through the encircling walls of flame.
Siakti and the others respect you, Kellis continued. Indeed, as Malahet, you have a reputation that reaches across Kian and beyond, and you shine in the third sight. But secretly, they all think you cursed by the solitary god. Why else would the water elude you? And without your eyes, your ability to discern what comes before is much reduced. The snakes are but pinholes. For years you waged futile war against your circumstance, and though your intellect could astound those about you and earn you access to their most privileged councils, the instant they found themselves beyond the force of your presence, the undermining whispers were rekindled. He is weak. Then, about 12 years ago, you discovered the first of the consult's skin spies, probably through discrepancies in their voices. The Kishorim were thrown into an uproar, that much is certain, and even though no one knew the slightest thing about the creatures, the blame was placed on the Scarlet Spires. For only the greatest of the schools, they thought, could dare, let alone execute, such an outrage. Infiltrate the Kishorim? But you were Dunyain, and though our brothers know nothing of the arcane, our understanding of the mundane is without peer. You realized that these things weren't sorcerous artifacts, that they were engines of the flesh. But you couldn't convince the others who sought to instruct the Scarlet Spires on the perilous course they had taken. There must be consequences. So the Kishorim assassinated the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires, prompting a war that will find its conclusion this very day. Just then, Kellis inadvertently kicked something lying upon the graven floor, something hollow and fibrous, a skull. But you, he continued without hesitation, kept the creatures, and over years of torment, you eventually broke them down. You learned of Golgotharoth, her ramparts heaped about the horns of an ancient derelict, a vessel fallen from the void in the days when non-men yet ruled Eärwa, of the Inkoroi, and the great war they waged against long-dead non-men kings. You learned how the last survivors of that fell race, Orang and Orax, perverted the heart of their non-men captor, Makaratrig, and how he corrupted Shoriatus, the Grand Master of the Mengekka, in his turn. You learned how this wicked cabal broke the glamour about Golgotharoth and made its horrors their own. You learned of the consult.
These words you speak, Moenga said from the black, wicked, corrupted, perverted. Why would you use them when you know they are nothing more than mechanisms of control?
Of course you had heard of the consult, Kellis continued, ignoring his question. And like most in the Three Seas, you thought them long dead, the stuff of mandate delusions. But the stories you extracted from your captives, there was too much consistency, too much detail for them to be fabrications. The deeper you probed, the more troubling the story became. You had read the sagas, and you had doubted them, thinking them too fanciful. Destroying the world? No malice could be so great. No soul could be so deranged. After all, what could be gained? Who follows paths over precipices? But the skin spies explained it all. Speaking in shrieks and howls, they taught you the why and wherefore of the apocalypse. You learned that the boundaries between the world and the outside were not fixed, that if the world could be cleansed of enough souls, it could be sealed shut. Against the gods, against the heavens and the hells of the afterlife, against redemption, and most importantly, against the possibility of damnation. The consult, you realized, were laboring to save their souls, and what was more, if your captives could be believed, they were drawing near the end of their millennial task. In the absence of light, Kellis studied his father through the lens of different senses, the scent of naked skin, the displacement of drafts, the sound of bare feet scuffling through the dark. The second apocalypse, Moenga said simply. Only you knew their secret. Only you could detect their spies. They have to be stopped, Moengus replied. Destroyed. So you brooded over what the skin spies told you, spent years immersed in the depths of the probability trance. From the very first, ever since descending the glaciers into the wastes of Kunayori, Kellis had pondered the man, now leading him through these galleries of darkness, scheme after probabilistic scheme, the branching of innumerable alternatives, waxing and waning with each mile walked, with every insight and apprehension. I'm here, Father, in the house you have prepared for me. You began, Kellis said, contemplating what would become the thousandfold thought. Yes, Moengus replied, a simple affirmation. Even as he said this, Kellis sensed the changes in acoustics, odors, even ambient temperature. The pitch-black corridor had opened onto a chamber of some kind, one where things still lived and where things had died, many things. We have arrived, his father said. Beneath the eaves of the clouds, the Enrithi knights of Setadon thundered across dead fields and stumped orchards. Pennants slapped against the smoking expanse of Shaima, the three black shields of Nangaelsa, the white stag of Numanieri, the red swords of Pleidiol, and other ancient marks of northern peoples. Beneath the black and gold circumfix, Lord Gothyelk, Earl of Agansinor, galloped before them, and all the world rumbled. The distance closed. More and more Fainim climbed the ramped banks of the Jeshimal and hastened to join the milling ranks. Arrows began falling among the Enrithi, disorganized volleys that either clattered harmlessly from their great kite shields or were stilled by thick pads of felt. Several horses fell screaming, throwing their riders to earth, but the masses simply parted about them and pounded on. Spurs urged chargers faster. Lances were lowered. Long-bearded warriors began roaring out to Gilgeol, mighty war. The heathen began charging toward them, haphazardly at first, like clutches of seed falling from laden trees, then en masse. The whole horizon moved, at once dark and many-colored. Among the Taidoni, some glimpsed the triangular standard of Kinganjahoy, the famed tiger of Umarna. The men of the Tusk leaned into their lances, both grinning and grimacing. It seemed they rattled the world to its foundations.
Shaima!
A voice pealed out, the grizzled old earl riding hard in their lead. Soon they were all shouting,
Shaima! Shaima! Shaima!
Then all was snapping wood and screaming horses, hacking swords and pummeling maces. Men shouting, dying. Gauzlas, son of Earl Kerjula, was the first of the caste nobility to fall, beheaded by silver-helmed Kinganjahoy himself. But his Warnutishmen, howling in grief, could not be broken, nor could any of the Taidoni. The Iron Men hammered down shields and smashed faces. They shattered scimitars with their long-notched swords. They brained shrieking horses. Then, like a miracle, they were reining to stop before blue and black waters. They had taken the riverbank. The grandees of Umarna were broken, killed or beaten away, but there was no respite. Like angry bees, the Fainim reassembled beyond their flanks, even behind them, riding in hard arcs, loosing arrow after arrow. Across the ground, the wounded howled through forests of stamping legs. The bridgeheads were retaken, and the Enrithi earls thundered at their men, exhorting them to hold them. Vicious melees raged across the bridges and the rapids, but the Fainim were already uncoupling the timber rafts that their mastodons had dragged from the leveling of the Tantana Gate. On the Jeshimal's far bank, all the world seemed to throng with the enemy. Fainim riders crowded onto the first of the rafts. More and more arrows fell among the Enrithi. Earl Gothyelk looked to the white-tiled walls of the city, saw that King Regent Kinjoza and his Ainani were yet in disarray. Many still crowded the parapets. Cursing, he commanded his hornsmen to sound the retreat. They had lost the Jeshimal. Kellis spoke a sorcerous word, and a point of light appeared, sheeting low-vaulted walls in illumination. Though ornate by Enrithi standards, the chamber was more austere than any he'd encountered since plumbing the darkness beneath Kayudia. The friezes that paneled the walls did not screen deeper carvings. They seemed more reserved in theme and content as well, as if the product of an older, more stolid age, though Kellis decided it had more to do with the room's function. It had been some kind of access chamber for the mansion's ancient sewers. Workbenches and strange iron and wood mechanisms littered the walls with shadow. At the far end of the chamber, where the ceiling sloped so low a man would have to stoop, a cistern opened beneath converging chutes, as dust-dry as everything else in the room. Nearer, two wells or pits had been dropped into the floor, each possessing graven lips that, perversely, had been carved into the semblance of hands reaching out of the darkness to tear at four spread-eagle figures, one for each point of the compass. With heads bent back in soundless howls, each clutched at the ground with stationary desperation. The two skin spies hung suspended above these pits, their arms and legs shackled in chains of pitted iron. Kellis approached the nearer one, stepping past a hanging funnel, part of a rust-grooved forced feeding mechanism. How many years had the thing hung here, dangling in absolute black, flinching from instruments, listening to the insistent cooing of his father's voice? With a gesture, he drew the point of light closer. Shadows swung like steepled fingers. Their facial limbs were drawn perpetually open with rust-brown wire affixed to an iron ring. A contraption of cords and pulleys allowed the thing's inner faces to be pulled back or down. "When did you realize you didn't possess the strength?" Kellis asked. "That more was needed to avert the No-God's second coming."
"From the very first, I recognized that it was probable," Moenga said. "But I spent years assessing the possibilities, gathering knowledge. When the first of the thought came to me, I was quite unprepared."
Their brain cases had been sawed open, revealing lobes and milky convolutions hazed by hundreds of silver needles. Neuropuncture. Kellis reached out a finger, brushed the tip of one near the brain's base. The creature jerked and stiffened. Excrement slopped down into the pit. The reek of it swelled through the room.
"I assume," Kellis continued, "that you're not entirely without water, that this was how you were able to reach out to Ishual, to send dreams to those Dunyane you knew before your exile."
Through intersecting chains, he saw his father nod, as hairless as the ancient non-men who had hewn the stone surrounding them. What secrets had he learned from these captives? What dread whispers?
"I have some facility for those elements of the Suka that require more subtlety than power. Scrying, calling, translating, even still, my summons to you nearly broke me. Ishual lies across the world."
"I was the shortest path."
"No, you were the only path."
Kellis examined the two squares of oak that had been laid across the floor on the far side of the wells. They looked like doors, only stripped of their hinges and handles, and set with hooks in each corner so that they could be hung directly beneath the skin spies. The child and woman nailed across them, tools his father had used either to fan or to sate the creature's lusts, hadn't been dead long. Their blood gleamed like wax. An interrogation technique? Or another feeding mechanism?
"And my half-brother?" Kellis asked.
In his soul's eye, it seemed he could almost see him, the pomp, the authoritarian grandeur. So many times had he heard him described. Kellis stepped around the far side of the skin spies to gain a clear view of his father. The man seemed wizened, all but naked in the glaring light, strangely bent or broken.
"He uses every heartbeat to reassess. His son has returned to him insane."
Moengus nodded and said,
"You mean Maythanet?"
Her head in the crook of his shoulder, Esmanette stared up through the trees. She breathed deep and low, tasting the salt of her tears, smelling the dank of mossy stone, the bitter of pinched green. Like little flags, the leaves swung and fluttered, their waxy clatter so clear against the background roar. It seemed marvelous and impossible. Twigs upon branches, branches upon limbs, all upward fanning, at once random and perfectly radial, all reaching for a thousand different heavens. She sighed and said, "I feel so young." His chest bounced in silent laughter beneath her cheek. "You are. Only the world is old."
"Oh, Akka, what are we going to do?"
"What we must."
"No, that's not what I mean."
She cast an urgent look to his profile.
"He'll see, Akka. The instant he glimpses our faces, he'll see us here. He'll know."
He turned to her, the scowling herd of old fears unearthed.
"Esme?"
The snort of a horse, loud and near, interrupted him. They looked to each other in confusion and alarm. Akamian crept back along the bruised V that marked their path through the weeds, crouched behind the scabbed masonry. She followed. Over his shoulder, she glimpsed a row of cavalry, obviously Imperial Kidrahil, arrayed in a long line across the heights. Dour, expressionless, the mailed horsemen stared out to the roaring city. Their horses stamped and snorted in nervousness. From the gathering clamor, she knew that more, very many more, approached from behind. Confis? Here? But he was supposed to be dead.
"You're not surprised,"
she whispered in sudden understanding. She leaned close to him.
"Did the Skilvendi tell you about this? Does his treachery run this deep?"
"He told me," Akamian said, his voice so hollow, so dismayed, that her skin prickled in terror. "And he told me to warn the great names. He didn't want any harm to befall the Holy War, for Proyas's sake as much as anything else, I think. But after he left, all I could think about was... He trailed, then turned to her, his eyes round.
"Stay here. Stay hidden."
She shrank backward, such was the intensity of his tone. She pressed her back against the forking of slender trunks.
"What are you talking about? Akka?"
"I can't let this happen, Esme. Confis has an entire army. Think of what will happen."
"That's exactly what I'm thinking about, you fool."
"Please, Esme, you're his wife. Think of what happened to Serwe." In her soul's eye, she glimpsed the girl, trying to palm blood back into the gash about her throat.
"Akka,"
she sobbed. "I love you, Esmanette. The love of a fool." He paused, blinked two tears. "That's all I've ever had to offer." Then suddenly he stood tall. Before she could speak, he had stepped over the broken foundation. There was something nightmarish to his movements, an urgency that couldn't be contained by his limbs. She would have laughed had she not known him so well. He walked out and among the cavalrymen, calling, his eyes shining, his voice a thunderclap. Emperor Icuri Confis I was in an uncommonly jubilant mood.
"A holy city afire," he said to the grave faces to either side of him. "Masses locked in battle."
He turned to the old Grand Master, who seemed to slump in his saddle.
"Tell me, Kemenketri, you schoolmen pretend to be wise, what does it say of men that we find such things beautiful?"
The black-robed sorcerer blinked as though trying to clear the room from his eyes.
"That we are bred to war, god of men."
"No,"
Confis replied, his tone at once playful and cross.
"War is intellect, and men are stupid. It's violence we're bred to, not war."
Astride his horse, the Emperor gazed down across the Enrethian encampment, out to where Shaima smoked and flickered with warring lights. In addition to the ailing Sake Grand Master, General Araya Mantaras, several sundry officers, and members of the Messenger Corps accompanied him, arrayed along the summit of the mounded ridge. His Kidrahil fanned out before him,
forming ranks lower on the slopes, near a series of ruined structures he couldn't be troubled to identify. His columns approached from behind, already drawn out into red and gold battle lines. Their timing had been impeccable. They had debarked from the fleet the night before, in a miraculous little harbor mere miles up the coast. Even the winds had been blessed. And now, he fairly cackled at what he saw. The scarlet spires engaged in the shadow of the Jutarum, half the holy war running heedless and amok through the smoking streets, Fanile striking to the south of the city, trying to outflank the stubborn Tidoni. Everything was exactly as his scouts had informed him. The men of the Tusk had no inkling of his arrival, which meant that Sompas, wherever he was, had succeeded in stopping the Skilvendi. 4 full columns, a veritable spear in the small of the holy war's back. Whom do the gods favor now, prophet? A defect carried from the womb? Please. He laughed aloud, utterly unperturbed by the ashen looks of his officers. Suddenly, it seemed he could see the future to its very limit. It wouldn't end here. Oh, my, no. It would continue. First, to the south, to Selokara, then onward to Nensafon, west to Invishi, all the way to Avangshe and the legendary gates of Zeum. He, Aikuri Confis the First, would be the new Triamus, the next Aspect Emperor of the Three Seas. He turned, scowling, to his retinue. How could they not see it? It was all so clear. But then they peered through the smoke of mortality. All they could see now was their precious holy city. But time would show. In the meantime, they need only follow— Who's that? General Araya Monteris abruptly muttered. Confis found and recognized the man immediately. Drusus Acamian, walking through the grass, turning toward them, his eyes and mouth ablaze. Groping for his koray, he screamed, "Kemen Kit!" But heat sucked all air from his lungs. He heard screams dissolve like salt into boiling broth. He was falling.
"To me, Emperor!" an aged voice cried. "To me!"
He was on the ground, rolling through grasses that had become black ash. Somehow, the Grand Master of the Imperial Sake was standing above him, his white hair whipping in convections, his sorcerous voice strong despite his unsteady stance. Ethereal ramparts distorted the air between them and the Mandate Sorcerer, who turned to the breaking ranks of Kidrahil. Lines of light swept out, more perfect than any rule, flashing across the nearest of the Imperial Heavy Cavalry, who collapsed, not bodily, but in sopping pieces that rolled between the hummocks and weeds. A blinding light rewrote all the shadows, and through upraised fingers, Confis saw a sun falling from black-bellied clouds plummeting onto the figure of the Mandate Schoolman. Bursting fire, ribbons of it arcing off in all directions. Confis heard himself cry out in relief, elation. But as his eyes adjusted, he saw the flames twining away into nothingness about an invisible sphere, and he glimpsed him, as clear as that night beneath the Andiamine Heights or in the Sapatishah's palace in Karaskand, Drusus Acamian, unharmed, untouched, laughing about incandescence as he sang. From nowhere, a massive concussion. The air just cracked. Kemen Khetri fell to one knee, made a curious gasping sound. Parabolas of light parsed the air about his half-shattered wards. The sound of iron teeth grinding at the world's very bones, Kemen Khetri's voice wavered in old man panic, words wrapped around gasps. Another concussion, and Confis found himself face first in the ash. His ears shrieked, but he could still make out the hoarse old voice howling.
Run!
And the Emperor ran, screaming. The Sake Grand Master's blood was blown like sleet across his back. Cursing, the lone guardsman before the Umbilica's silk and canvas entrance shot to his feet. He blinked at the approaching figure, which did not move right. At moments it seemed a man, but at others it seemed something else, like a moth's pupa
or a bundle of collapsing cloth. Something flattened from all directions, though it did not grow smaller. And the air seemed to crackle as though somewhere, just out of sight, sheaves of papyrus burned. He stood rigid, breathless. Everything in his body, deeper even, clamored for him to run. But he was one of the 100 pillars. It was shame enough to be left behind, but to fail in this? He drew his longsword, cried out, "Halt!" more from bewilderment than anything else. And miraculously, the thing ceased moving. Forward anyway, because it somehow clawed outward, as though soft inner surfaces were being peeled back, exposed to the needling sky. A face like summer sunlight, limbs barked in fire. Reaching out, the thing grasped his head, skinned it like a grape.
"Where?"
bolted a voice through his smoking skull.
"Is Drusus a Camion?"
Fire and light, burnishing the underside of black wheeling clouds, carving the outer pillars of the first temple bright against a heart of inscrutable black. Heeding the thunder of their Grand Master's voice, the flanking cadres of the scarlet spires drew back before the flailing lights, falling into a great circle across the devastation they had brought to the foot of the sacred heights. The more numerous Kishorim assailed them, the snakes about their throats craning forward. In trios, the weaker crouched and dashed through the ruins, white-blue energy spilling from their foreheads like water toppling toward unseen grounds. The stronger floated proud, dispensing great scourging torrents. All across the leveled streets, there were blinding points of contact where pure light broke against the ghosts of cracking stone. Between singing cants and renewing wards, the sorcerers of rank cried instructions and encouragement to their Javra shield-bearers. Now and again, when one of the slave soldiers stumbled across the treacherous footing, a Kore would whirr out of the fire and darkness. Hamar Kaidu was struck, so perfectly balanced, he remained standing as incandescent lashes snapped through his fading defenses, a pillar of salt amid sizzling, screaming ruin. The circle closed. The schoolmen abandoned their encircling wards and began fencing the spaces before them with far more robust directional wards. The quick-spoken portcullis, the difficult yet mighty ramparts of Ur. Then they responded in kind. To its bones, Shaima shivered with unholy reverberations. The terrible majesty of the dragon head, the scalding horror of the Memcotic Furies, the air-sucking whoosh of the Mepa Cataract. Dozens of lesser Kishorim vanished in gold-boiling torrents. Others were dragged smoking from the sky. Abandoning their positions to the rear of their cadres, many Rumkari, the Scarlet Spire's famed Kore crossbowmen, crept forward through the rubble, began shooting bolts at those mighty few who seemed immune to sorcerous fires. They blinked at glimpses of snakes and faces, black against sheeted white. But the crossbowmen within the circle turned, their eyes drawn skyward by shouts, and saw Kishorim dropping through smoke, landing in their midst. Within moments, before the flying walls of debris crashed over them, they had killed more than a dozen. But the Kishorim neither relented nor faltered, for they were Indara's water-bearers, the firstborn of the solitary god, and unlike their wicked foemen, they cared not for their lives. In the midst of their enemy, they spilled their water. The slaughter was great. The Fainim jeered and pelted them with arrows as they fled the banks of the river Jeshimal. The retreat quickly became a rout. Soon, scattered bands of Tidoni were careering across the fields, racing toward the line of arched ruin that was the Canaan Aqueduct. Some riders halted to save their unhorsed thanes, only to be overrun by the pursuing tides of heathen horsemen. Save for the thunder of sorcery, Kianine drums and ululations owned the skies. But the sturdy footmen of Setadon, under the command of Gathyelk's eldest son, Gotharus, were already assembling beneath the aqueduct. With every passing moment, more spears and many-colored shields spanned the gaps between the crumbling pylons. to the north, where the aqueduct trailed into a linear mound before the Tatokar walls. The Einani were also drawing into defensive positions. Palatine Uranyanka howled at his Mozorothi to close the gap with the Taidoni, Nangales under Earl Iyengar. Lord Soter led his bloodthirsty Kishyati in a desperate charge from the north. Trailing skirts of dust, the Knights of Setadon thundered haphazardly into the ranks of their countrymen. Most pressed their way to the rear, seeking respite, but some, like Werage and Greatheart, wheeled with their households and, roaring out encouragement, braced for the heathen onslaught. Missiles rained among them, like hail across tin.
"Here!"
Earl Gothjelk of Agansanor roared.
"Here we stand!"
But the Fainim parted before them, content to release storms of whirring arrows. The Knights of Kishat, their faces painted dread-white above their square-plaited beards, had exacted a terrible toll on their flank. But even more, Kinganjahoy recalled well the obstinacy of the idolaters once their heels touched ground. As yet, only a fraction of the Fainim army had crossed the Jeshimal. Fanael Abkaskamandri was coming, Lord of the Cleansed Lands, Padiraja of Holy Kian. Past the Asharsa market, through slums and tangled alleyways, the Conryans battled and chased the Fainim, losing more and more of their number to rapine and plunder, drawing up only when they reached the broad reed marshes that had once been Shima's great harbor. Proyas had long since abandoned any attempt to impose order or restraint on his men. The madness of battle was on them, and though his heart grieved it, he understood what it meant to wager one's life, and the bestial license that men took as their prize. Shima, it seemed, was no exception. It wasn't. Separated in the pursuit, he found himself wandering the murky streets. He came upon a small market square, where the escarpment of facades and cornices fell away, allowing him to see the heights of the Jutaram, the heterine walls painted in flickering lights, the tall columns of the first temple, a motionless blue. Smoke rose from the height's footings to the west, great tattered curtains of it, climbing the way sand might fall through clear water. Boiling upward, it passed into and merged with the unnatural clouds, so that the whole of heaven seemed a thing of smoke spilling outward across the plane of an immense ceiling. It wasn't. He looked across the abandoned kiosks, sunk into the buildings before him, only to glimpse what seemed to be a tusk in the shadowy confines of one. Scowling against the press of his war mask, he wandered past the threshold, past ropes hung with workaday pottery, shelves cluttered with wooden bowls and plates. There it was, the size of his forearm, perhaps, painted in pitch across a humble door. The crude simplicity of it struck a pang in the back of his throat. A giddiness, something like fear or expectation, made haze of his heart and limbs, the same as when his mother had brought him to temple as a child. He raised a hand, felt the wood through the iron links about his fingertips. He caught his breath when the door swung open. Aside from sleeping mats, the room was unfurnished, the abode of debt slaves, perhaps. A man, a common Amati by the look of him, sat slumped against the wall to his right, where he appeared to have bled to death. The haft of a knife lay just beyond the reach of his purple fingers. Another man, one of the Kianin they had fought across the Asharsa, lay sprawled across the floor, face downward. The floor listed toward the far wall so that the blood spilled away, sheeting the planks, gumming about wood shavings, stretching thin claws along the grouted seams. Almost invisible in the murk, a woman and a juvenile girl cringed in the far corner, watching him with horror-round eyes. He remembered his silver war mask, raised it. He savored the sudden cool across his face. The fear of the woman did not diminish, though he had thought that it would. He looked down, and as though for the first time, saw the blood daubed and smeared across his white and blue kalat. He raised his gauntleted hands. They, too, had been slicked in crimson. Memories of savagery, of hacking death, of screams and horrified curses. Memories of Sumna, his forehead pressed against Mathanet's knee, weeping as one reborn. How had he come so far? Despite the rumbling drums and the distant horns, his footsteps seemed to burst across the silence. Thud, thud. The mother wailed and rocked as he approached, began babbling something, something.
Maruta, Kal, Algarita. Maruta, Maruta.
She desperately pawed at the blood across her lower lip and chin, then smeared across the floor at his booted feet. A tusk?
Maruta,
she bawled, though whether she meant tusk or mercy, he could not tell. They screamed and shrank as he reached for them. He pulled the girl to her feet, found her lightness at once terrifying and arousing. She flailed at him ineffectually, then went very still, as though his hands might be jaws. The mother bawled and beseeched, smeared tusk after tusk across the gritty floor. No, Prosha. It wasn't supposed to be... not like this. But then, it never was. It seemed he could smell the girl over the reek of smoke and entrails. No perfumes. At once sour and musky and clean. The smell of young promise. He turned her to the sourceless light. Cropped black hair, brimming eyes, swollen cheeks. By the gods, she was lovely, this daughter of his enemy. Narrow hips, long legs. If he were to strike her, would he feel death at the end of his arm? If he were to grow hot upon her? An enormous crack shivered the air, thrummed through the building's bones. Run, he murmured, though he knew she wouldn't understand. He pulled her back, held a soiled hand out to raise the mother. You must find a better place to hide. This was Shima. In this world, Moenga said, there's nothing more precious than our blood, as you have no doubt surmised. But the children we bear by world-born women lack the breadth of our abilities. Mathanet is not Dunyain. He could do no more than prepare the way. Her name arose like a pang from the darkness. Esmanet. Only a true son of Ishual could succeed, his father continued. For all the thousandfold thoughts, innumerable deductions, for all its elegance, there remained countless variables that could not be foreseen. Each of its folds possesses a haze of catastrophic possibilities, most of them remote, others nearly certain. I would have abandoned it long ago, were not the consequences of inaction so absolute. Only one of the conditioned could follow its path. Only you, my son. Could it be? A tincture of sorrow in his father's voice? Kellis turned from the hanging skin spies, once again enclosed his father within the circle of his scrutiny. You speak as though the thought were a living thing. He could see nothing in the eyeless face. Because it is. Moenga stepped between the two hanging skin spies. Though blind, he unerringly reached out to run a finger down one of the many hanging chains. Have you heard of a game played in southern Nilnamesh? A game called Virimsata, or Many Breaths?
No.
Across the plain surrounding the city of Invishi, the ruling caste nobles are very remote, very effete. The narcotics they cultivate assure them of the obedience of their populations. Over the centuries, they have elaborated Jinan to the point where it has eclipsed their old faiths. Entire lives are spent in what we would call gossip. But Virimsata is far different from the rumors of the court or the clucking of harem eunuchs. Far more. The players of Virimsata have made games of truth. They tell lies about who said what to whom, about who makes love to whomever, and so on. They do this continually, and what is more, they are at pains to act out the lies told by others, especially when they are elegant, so they might make them true. And so it goes from tongue to lip to tongue, until no distinction remains between what is a lie and what is true. In the end,
at a great ceremony, it is the most compelling tale that is declared Pirvirsut, a word that means this breath is ground in ancient Vaparsi. The weak, the inelegant have died, while others grow strong, yielding only to the Pirvirsut, the breath that is ground. Do you see? The Viramsata, they become living things, and we are their battle plane. Kellis nodded. Like Inrithism and Fainamry. Precisely. Lies that have conquered and reproduced over the centuries. Delusional worldviews that have divided the world between them. They are twin Viramsata that even now war through shouts and limbs of men. Two great thoughtless beasts that take the souls of men as their ground. And the thousandfold thought? Moengus turned to him, as precisely as if he could see. An instigator that goads them, that bleeds them even as we speak. A formula of events that will rewrite the very course of history. A great transition rule that will see Inrithism and Fainamry transformed. The thousandfold thought is all these things. Beliefs beget action, Kellis. If men are to survive the dark years to come, they must all act of one accord. So long as there are Inrithi and Fainam, this will not be possible. They must yield before a new delusion, a new breath that is ground. All souls must be rewritten. There is no other way. And the truth? Kellis asked. What of that? There is no truth for the world-born. They feed and they couple, cozening their hearts with false flatteries, easing their intellects with pathetic simplifications. The Logos for them is a tool of their lust, nothing more. They excuse themselves and heap blame upon others. They glorify their people over other peoples, their nation over other nations. They focus their fears on the innocent. And when they hear words such as these, they recognize them, but as defects belonging to others. They are children who have learned to disguise their tantrums from their wives and their fellows, and from themselves most of all. No man says, they are chosen and we are damned. No world-born man. They have not the heart for truth. Stepping from between his faceless captives, Moengus approached, his expression a mask of blind stone. He reached out as though to clasp Kellis's wrist or hand, but halted the instant Kellis shrank back. But why, my son? Why ask me what you already know? She clutched the crumbling walls, ducked to see past the fronds of sumac. Something, a high wind perhaps, worried the darkling clouds that shadowed the holy city. A corona of gold had formed along their outer rim, and sunlight showered across the slopes above the Holy War's encampment upon the ruined mausoleums of the ancient Amati kings. Even still, the sorcerer flared with impossible brilliance, his eyes bright burning orbs, his mouth working about glaring white. From where Esmanet watched, Akamian was no longer Akamian, but something altogether different, something godlike and all-conquering. Multiple spheres of light englobed him, each bisected with further shielding disks. Brilliant lines webbed the slopes surrounding him, glittering geometries that sundered all but the thickest bodies and the hardest steel. The abstractions of the Gnosis, the war cants of the ancient North. His voice, and no matter how unearthly, it remained his voice, had become a sing-song mutter that descended from all directions, that tingled against her fingertips when she pressed the stone. Despite her terror and confusion, she knew that at long last she saw him, the one whose long shadow had always chilled their hopes, darkened their love, the Mandate Schoolman. From what she could see, the Nansur were in utter confusion. The Kidrahil had broken, dispersed into the distances where still the far-flung lines of the Gnosis found them. The air rang with frantic alarms. She was no fool. She knew there would be Koray,
that it was only a matter of time before the units of crossbowmen or some such fought their way through the confusion. But how long would it take? How long could he survive? She was about to watch him die, she realized, the only man who truly loved her. From nowhere, it seemed, golden fires rolled over him, burning the earth about his wards to glass. Then lightning struck, brilliant spasms of it, scrawling across the glowing plains. She stumbled along the interior of the ruined wall, struggled to find a footing, then pulled herself up to look westward. Her heart caught at the sight of the imperial columns, their ranks piling across the distances. Then she saw them. Along the crest, standing the height of a tree above the ground, four black-robed sorcerers, wrapped in spectral bastions of stone. They sang dragons, they sang lightning, lava, and sun. Twice the concussions knocked her from her perch. One by one, the Mandate schoolmen pulled them down, each with blistering precision. The holy water of the Indara Kishori fell sideways across the heaped earth, spiraling from souls that had become fissures. Dozens of scarlet schoolmen, too engrossed or startled to sing new encircling wards, screamed in the scalding light. Entire cadres were swept away in deluge after glittering deluge. Narstheba, Inrumi. Death came swirling down. Kisharam were struck down with kore, quick, soundless flashes, like tissue cast into flame, but then so too were schoolmen, by the Thesji bowmen who dashed through the smoke-hazed ruin. Within heartbeats, the circle was broken. An organized battle became sorcerous melee. Each schoolman found himself warring alone with his stunned cadre, both to live and to kill. Their shouts were lost in the thunder of their destruction. The Kishorim were everywhere among them, standing in clutches, behind broken walls, upon mounded debris, blue-burning beacons. Geysers erupted along the sheer brick surfaces, leaving deep pocks that trailed dust and gravel. Bricks fell like powdered plaster. Many of the Kishorim, the secondaries and tertiaries, they killed with single dragon heads. The primaries they hammered and hammered, either singly or in concert, only to find themselves falling to their knees, screaming out ward after desperate ward. The Scarlet Spires knew of the nine Incandati, those primaries whose backs could bear the most water, but they had no inkling as to their true strength. Now the greatest of the Sukari assailed them, Siakti, Inkorot, Habhara, Fanfarokar, Sartmandri, and they could not cope. Within moments of closing with Inkorot, Sarasthenes was singing wards only. Dazzling light crashed all about him, striking with such force that it seemed the very joists of the world must crack. His Javra shield-bearers wailed about him, struggling to find their feet. The ghost stone cracked, was torn away in sheets. His song ran out, and all was brilliant agony. Eleazaris had been very near the Kishorim's surprise descent. Beset by Fanfarokar and Siakti, the High Heresiarch himself, he too could do no more than sing ward after ward. The Heresiarch hung over half windows directly before him, his asps curved to watch the surrounding ruin, his figure bleached white by his impossible dispensations. Fanfarokar assailed him from the right, shielded in the crotches of a ruined tabernacle. The words, the words! The Grand Master bent all his craft and cunning to the words, both silent and spoken. The world beyond his defenses was rocked and blasted by deafening light. He sang and he sang to keep his narrow circle safe. He had not the luxury of despair. Then a moment of miraculous respite. The world went dark save for the wicked glow of the fires. Through the whoosh and crackling, Eleazaris heard a horn, lonely and crude, crying out over the fields of ruin. All, sorcerer and Kishorim alike, peered about in blinking confusion. Then Eleazaris saw them, demon red in the gloom, assembled in a long line across the broken ground. The Thunieri, their black armor sheened in blood, their corn-silk beards tousled by the wind of great fires burning. He saw the circumfix, black on red,
pinned to the standard of Prince Hulwarga. Men of the Tusk, come to save them. Masses of Kianine horsemen encompassed the fields before them, line after rumbling line of them, trotting directly toward the ruined aqueduct. Waiting with butted spear and hoisted shield, the men of the Tusk watched them, marking the standards of foes now well known. The Kyrgwi tribes, bent on completing the work of the desert, the grandees of Nensifan and Kianadini, who had suffered so terribly beneath the walls of Karaskand, the Girgashi of King Pilaskanda, leading some 24 of their dread mastodons, the survivors of Gedea and Shigek under Ansaser, the long-suffering horsemen of Umarna and Jurisada under Kinganjahoy, who time and again had driven the Inrithi before him, and beneath the Padiraja's own banner, the fearless Kuyori, the ringlets of their mail gleaming gold where open sky found them. All that remained of a proud and fierce nation, come for a final reckoning. To the left of the Inrithi, over the heart of the city, smoke trailed like gauze and water, obscuring the first temple and the sacred heights. Lights glowered and flickered from within, glimpses of brilliance through rags of black. Booms and thunder broke across the distances, more fell than the pulse of heathen drums. The braided nangales began singing first, then the Numanieri, one of the warrior prophet's unearthly hymns. Soon the entire Inrithi line was awash with deep warrior voices singing, "We, the sons of past sorrow, we, the heirs of ancient Trow, shall raise glory to the morrow, and shall deliver fury to the now." The Kianine quickened to the pace of crashing cymbals, rank after rank of them, roping field and pasture with dark color. Then suddenly the cohorts were racing as though one against another. Riding at the fore, the Sapatishas thrust their scimitars high and cried out. Their grandees and the fiercest of their kinsmen answered, and soon all howled in outrage and injury. So many wrongs suffered, so many deaths unavenged. The ground swept beneath them. Not fast enough, not fast enough. Men wept for awe and hatred, and it seemed the solitary god heard them. The Skellura Aqueduct stretched before them, a perfect line that ran from city to horizon, long tracks of it intact, arches piled across arches and sections completely collapsed. Crowded between the ruined pilings and across the scree, ranks of the Inrithi barricaded its foundations, a wall of shields and wicked men. The distance closed, the moments thinned to impossibility. For a heartbeat, song warred with inarticulate clamor. "We shall raise glory to the morrow!" Then all the world erupted. Lances snapped, shields cracked, some horses shied and reared while others bowled through. Men stabbed and hooked, song and cry both faltered and shrieks claimed the sky. From the heights of the aqueduct, Inrithi archers rained incessant ruin. Others heaved blocks and stones onto the heaving masses below. Here and there, heathen burst through to the far side, where the waiting Taidoni and Einani knights instantly charged into them. Bloodshed and melee seethed along the length of the Inrithi line. "Even the Dunyane," Moenga said, "possess vestigial versions of these weaknesses. Even me, even you, my son." The implication was clear. Your trial has broken you. Was this what had happened beneath the black boughs of Umiaki? Kellis could remember rising from Serwe's corpse, the hands wrapping him in white linen. He could remember blinking at the flash of sunlight through the leafy gloom. He could remember walking when he should be dead, and seeing them in their thousands, the men of the Tusk, crying out in astonishment and relief and exultation, in awe. "There's more, father. Your Kishorim, you must know this." He could remember the voice. "What do you see?" Even without eyes, his father's face still seemed to scrutinize. "You refer to your visions, the voice from nowhere. But tell me, where is your proof? What assures your claim over those who are simply mad?
Tell me.
Assurance? What assurance did he have? When the real punished, the soul denied. He had seen it so many times in so many eyes, so how could he be so certain?
But on the plains of Mengeda, he said, the Shrial Knights, what I prophesied, came to pass.
To the world-born, these words would have sounded blank, devoid of concern or occasion, but to a Dunyane,
let him think I waver.
A fortuitous correspondence of cause, Moengus replied, nothing more. That which comes before yet determines that which comes after. How else could you have achieved all that you have achieved? How else could you be possible?
He was right. Prophecy could not be. If the ends of things governed their beginnings, if what came after determined what came before, then how could he have mastered the souls of so many? And how could the thousandfold thought come to rule the three seas? The principle of before and after simply had to be true, if its presumption could so empower.
His father had to be right. So what was this certainty, this immovable conviction, that he was wrong? Am I mad?
The Dunyane, Moengus continued, think the world closed, that the mundane is all there is, and in this they are most certainly wrong. This world is open, and our souls stand astride its bounds. But what lies outside, Kellis, is no more than a fractured and distorted reflection of what lies within. I have searched for nearly the length of your entire life, and I have found nothing that contradicts this principle.
Men cannot see this because of their native incapacities. They attend only to what confirms their fears and their desires, and what contradicts, they either dismiss or overlook. They are bent upon affirmation. The priests crow over this or that incident, while they pass over all others in silence. I have watched, my son. For years I have counted, and the world shows no favor. It is perfectly indifferent to the tantrums of men. The god sleeps. It has ever been thus. Only by striving for the absolute may we awaken him. Meaning, purpose, these words name not something given. No, they name our task.
Kella stood motionless. Set aside your conviction, Moengus said. For the feeling of certainty is no more a marker of truth than the feeling of will is a marker of freedom. Deceived men always think themselves certain, just as they always think themselves free. This is simply what it means to be deceived.
Kellis looked to the halos about his hands, wondered that they could be light and yet cast no light, throw no shadow, the light of delusion.
But we, my son, do not have the luxury of error. Void has come to this world. It fell from the skies thousands of years past. Twice it has reared from the ashes of its falling. The first time in what the Mandate call the Kuno Inkoroi Wars. The second time in what they call the First Apocalypse. It is about to arise a third time.
Yes, Kellis murmured. He speaks to me as well.
What am I?
The No-God? Moengus asked. He paused momentarily. Had his father possessed eyes, Kellis was certain he would have seen them fall in and out of focus as the consciousness within rose and submerged.
Then you truly are mad.
The shouts were everywhere, descending from blinding, blinking sunlight.
Emperor, God of men!
His men, his glorious columnaries, come to save him.
He's dead! No, no, no!
Sweet Sejanus, our prayers have been answered.
Sedition! I should run you!
What? You think I value my skin over my so?
He's right! We all know it! We've all been thinking!
Then you're all guilty of treason. Are we? And what of this madman? What kind of fool would trade souls for ink and glory? Exactly! I'll be hanged before I fight for Feynum pigs! What, risk my life to fight for my own damnation?
He's right,
Look! A voice cried immediately above him. He moves!
For a moment, Confis could hear nothing for the ringing in his ears. Then there were arms and hands, many of them, dragging him by his harness. His heels bounced over turf. All he could think was to hold fast his quarry. What had happened? What had happened? He glimpsed his hands, which he had raised to his face, saw his trinket, greasy with blood. He cried out, sick with sudden certainty of his doom. His heart felt like a sparrow battling in his breast.
I'm dead. I've been slain.
Then he remembered, and he was fighting, striking away hovering hands.
Drusus Acamian.
Kill him!
He barked, pressing himself to his feet. Columnaries and officers surrounded him, gawking in wonder and terror. Men of the Celial Column. Confis snatched the cloak of one, used it to mop the blood from his face and neck. Kemenketri's blood, the imbecile, useless, feeble.
Kill him!
But only a few matched his gaze. The others looked past him, toward the rounded summit. He noticed the strange shadows that played about all of their feet. The ringing in his ears fell away, and Confis heard it, the thrum of their otherworldly song. Whirling, he saw Sake Schoolman astride the sky, pitching sorcerous ruin over the far side of the humped pasture. As he watched, one of the black-robed sorcerers foundered, his wards crumbling beneath the calligraphy of linear lights. He fell, flaming to the ground, as would the others. Four anagogic sorcerers would not be enough, not against the Gnosis. Confis cursed himself for dividing the imperial Sake between the columns. With the Kishorum and the Scarlet Spires locked in mortal struggle, he had assumed that
this isn't happening. Not to me. My core,
he said numbly.
Where are my crossbowmen?
No one could answer, of course. All was in disarray. The Mandate filth had obliterated his entire command. The Emperor's own standard had vanished in an eruption of fire. The sacred standard destroyed. He turned from the spectacle, scanned the surrounding fields and pastures. Kidrahil fled to the south. Fled! Three of his columns had halted, while the phalanxes of the farthest, the Nasoret, actually seemed to be withdrawing. They thought he was dead. Laughing, he pressed his way through the clutch of soldiers, opened his bloodied arms to the far-flung ranks of the Imperial Army. He hesitated at the sight of white-garbed horsemen cresting the far rise, but only for a heartbeat.
"Your Emperor has survived!" he roared. "The Lion of Kaiuth lives!"
Flames, tongues wrapped about golden tongues, spitting plumes of smoke into the sky. Without any apparent signal, the Thunieri began advancing, hundreds of them spilling into the trenches, climbing debris slopes, leaping through windows stranded in solitary walls. They raised no battle cry. Like wolves, they floated soundlessly forward. The Kishorum recollected themselves. Gouts of light plummeted across the smashed landscape, fell among the rushing Norserai warriors. Keening screams, shadows thrashing in boiling light. For heartbeats, all the Grand Master could do was stare dumbfounded. He saw one barbarian, his beard and hair aflame, stumble across the pitch of fallen walls, still holding a circumfix banner high. Without warning, the deluge found Eleazarus once again, arcs of inchoate energy that cracked and shattered his wards. He cried out his song, propping and renewing, all the while knowing it would not be enough. How had their foemen become so strong? But then the dread lights were halved, then halved yet again. Gasping, Eleazarus glimpsed the giant Yelgrota, soot blackened and blood-smeared, heaving Fanfarokar into the air by the throat. The asps flayed, fist closed about a core, the Thunieri giant hammered the shaven skull into sopping ruin. Eleazarus whirled, searching the heaped darkness for threats, saw Siakti floating backward before a rush of black shadows toward the fires that fenced the sloped foundations of the sacred heights. He saw the remaining cadres of his brothers, so few, light up in renewed fury.
Fight!
He thundered in a sorcerous voice.
Fight, schoolman, fight!
Out of his entire cadre, only one of his shield-bearers remained, cringing at his feet. He had no idea what had happened to the others. Cursing the fool, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spire stepped into the smoke-rent sky. The white roar of battle. Felled by heathen arrows, men toppled from the heights of the aqueduct onto the straining masses below. Swords and scimitars rising and falling, throwing blood into black skies. Shields braced against the necks of maddened horses. Astonished men, gauntlets pressed against mortal wounds. Raging men, hacking and hammering at the crush before them. Weeping men, dragging the lolling corpses of their lords. Then the Phanum fell back, leaving the fallen curled and stretched across the ground behind them. They retreated, as waters might from the breakers. All along the Scalora aqueduct, the Enrithi roared in exultation. One of the Numenieri stepped forward and, waving his sword back and forth, cried,
"Wait! You forgot your blood!"
Hundreds laughed. The dead were culled from the ranks. Messengers were dispatched along the rear of the line. For 7 seasons, the men of the Tusk had lived and breathed war. The routines seemed as near to them as their bones and blood. More Enrithi climbed to the rutted heights of what had become their wall, where the sight of the Phanum massing and reforming across the fields stole their breath. Horns signaled. Someone, somewhere, resumed their song. "We shall raise glory to the morrow. We shall bring fury to the now." Out of bowshot, the Phanum congregated anew about their bright banners. For a short time, only the south saw battle, as Ensacer led his cohorts, men as hard-bitten as the idolaters, up the pastures that ramped the shrine of Azoria. Though dreadfully outnumbered, Lord Gotian and his shrial knights sailed down the slopes toward him.
"God!"
the warrior monks cried.
"Wills it!"
And they met, hammer to hammer. Along the length of the aqueduct, the men of the Tusk cheered at the sight of heathen fleeing back down the slopes. Then the rhythm of the drums slowed, and with a clash of cymbals, the great masses of heathen before them began trotting forward. The first of the Enrithi arrows climbed into the sky, fired by the Agmundermen with their powerful yew bows. The archers of other nations soon joined them, though it seemed their volleys fell for naught into the slow advancing tide. Suddenly, in the disjointed manner of great assemblies, the Phanum host reined to a halt, a mere 100 paces before the ranks drawn across the aqueduct's foundations. Everywhere, stitched across flapping banners, painted across round shields, the horsemen bore the 2 scimitars of Phanumry. Their horses, caparisoned in skirts of fine iron rings, stamped and snorted, but beneath their helms the expressions of the Phanum possessed a murderous calm. Struck by wonder, the men of the Tusk let their song trail. Even the archers lowered their bows. With no more than the dead and slender tracts of ground between them, the sons of Fane and Sejanus regarded one another. Sunlight, showered across the fields, gleamed from clammy metal. Blinking, men looked to the heavens, saw vultures circling the glare. Mastodons screamed among the Girgashi. An anxious rustling passed through the lines, both heathen and idolater. Spotters along the aqueduct's crown shouted out warnings. Heathen horsemen seemed to be repositioning themselves behind their motionless brethren. But all eyes were drawn to the Koyari, where the banner of the Padiraja himself pressed forward through the ranks, the maned desert tiger embroidered in silver on a triangular bolt of black silk. The rose parted, and draped in golden mail, Fanile himself spurred his black onto the intervening ground.
"Who?"
he cried to the astonished onlookers, and in Shaik no less.
"Who is the true voice of God?"
His voice was youthful and strident, but it was also a signal to his kinsmen. Thousands erupted forward, lances lowered, mouths howling. Limbs numb in shock, the Enrithi braced themselves. The sun's heat now seemed to sicken. Fenial led a hurtling wedge of Koyori into the Gesindelmen and their Galioth brothers, all those who had elected to abandon King Sauban in Karaskand. Earl Anferig cried out to his blue-tattooed countrymen, but the surprise was too much. All seemed confusion. The forward ranks had been bowled under, and the heathen cavalrymen hacked and slashed in their very midst. The Putti Raja fought his way into the shadow of the arches while his bowmen raked the summit of the aqueduct above. A sudden cheer boomed out among the heathen, for Kinganjahoy had broken through the Ainani farther to the north and now fenced with Lord Soter and his merciless Kishyati knights. Heeding the calls of their Putti Raja, the Koyori redoubled their fury, battled their way forward through to the sunlight on the far side. Then suddenly they were galloping across open turf, cutting down the scrambling survivors. The glorious grandees of Nensifon and Kianadini streamed into their wake. But the thanes and knights of Setadon awaited them. In wave after wave, the iron men crashed into the expanding mass of heathen. Lances shattered arms, threw men from saddles. Horses jostled neck to neck, hoof to hoof. Swords and scimitars rang. Kissing the golden tusk that hung about his neck, Earl Gothyelk charged directly toward the Putti Raja standard. His householders scattered several dozen Koyari, fought their way forward. The Earl, whom his men called the Old Hammer, laid low all who dared oppose him. Then he found himself knee to grieve with Golden Fenial. According to witnesses, the confrontation was short-lived. The Earl's famed mace was no match for the Putti Raja's swift blade. Hoga Gothyelk, the red-faced Earl of Agansinor, leader of the Tidoni over the sea, slumped from his saddle. Death came swirling down. There was a sterility to the sorcerous light, a pallor that refused to discriminate the stone of the non-man carvings from the flesh of his father's face and limbs.
Tell me, father, what is the no-god?
Moengis stood motionless before him.
The trial broke you.
His time, Kellis knew, was running short. He could no longer afford his father's distractions.
If it was destroyed, if it no longer exists, how could it send me dreams?
You confuse the madness within you for the darkness without, the same as the world-born.
The skin spies, what have they told you? What is the no-god?
Though walled in by the flesh of his face, Moengus seemed to scrutinize him.
They do not know. But then, none in this world know what they worship.
What are the possibilities you've considered?
But his father would not relent.
The darkness comes before you, Kellis. It owns you. You are one of the conditioned. Surely you...
He paused abruptly, turned his blind face to open air.
You have brought others? Who?
Then Kellis heard them as well, creeping through black toward their light and their voices. There were three of them, the Skilvendi he recognized by his heartbeat. But who accompanied him?
I have been chosen, father. I am the harbinger.
The quiet of alternating breaths, the sound of grit beneath palm and heel.
These voices, Moengus said with slow deliberation. What do they say of me?
His father, Kellis realized, had finally grasped the principles of this encounter. Moengus had assumed that his son would be the one requiring instruction. He had not foreseen it as possible, let alone inevitable, that the thousandfold thought would outgrow the soul of its incubation and discard it.
They warn me, Kellis said, that you are Dunyane still.
One of the captive skin spies convulsed against its chains, vomited threads of spittle into the pit below.
I see. And this is why I am to die?
Kellis looked to the halos about his hands.
The crimes you've committed, father, the sins. When you learn of the damnation that awaits you, when you come to believe, you will be no different from the Inkoroi. As Dunyane, you will be compelled to master the consequences of your wickedness. Like the consult, you will come to see tyranny in what is holy, and you will war as they war. Kellis fell back into himself, opened his deeper soul to the details of his father's nearly naked form, assessing, appraising, the strength of limbs, the speed of reflexes. Must move quickly.
To shut the world against the outside, the pale lip said, to seal it through the extermination of mankind.
As Ishual is shut against the wilderness, Kellis replied. For the Dunyane, it was axiomatic. What was compliant had to be isolated from what was unruly and intractable. Kellis had seen it many times, wandering the labyrinth of possibilities that was the thousandfold thought, the warrior prophet's assassination, the rise of an Asarimber Moengus to take his place, the apocalyptic conspiracies, the counterfeit war against Golgotharoth, the accumulation of premeditated disasters, the sacrifice of whole nations to the gluttony of the Srank, the three seas crashing into char and ruin, the gods baying like wolves at a silent gate. Perhaps his father had yet to apprehend this. Perhaps he simply couldn't see past the arrival of his son. Or perhaps all this, the accusations of madness, the concern over his unanticipated turn, was simply a ruse. Either way, it was irrelevant. You are Dunyane still, father?
Azar.
The eyeless face, once perfectly obdurate and inscrutable, suddenly twitched in the ghost of a grimace. Kellis pulled his knife from his father's chest, retreated several steps. He watched his father probe the wound with his fingers, a weeping perforation just beneath his ribcage.
I am more, the warrior prophet said.
A broad swath of ground cooked and smoked about him. A Kamian world turned in a half-circle, saw the last of the fleeing Kidrahil, the Enrethian campment congesting the near reaches of the plain, and Shima, still dark beneath the clouds, bleeding smoke. He looked back to the crest, to where two of the four Sake schoolmen lay burning. The whole of the Imperial army, he realized, climbed the far side. Any second now, their banners would float above the grasses and wildflowers. He recalled his mandate training, just below high ground. He needed to run, to where the approach of Koray Bowman could be seen and where the earth provided the most cover. But part of him already mourned the futility of it. The only reason he had survived this long was that he'd caught them so entirely unawares. That wouldn't last. Not with Confis still breathing.
I'm dead.
Then he remembered Esmanet. How could he forget? He looked to the ruined mausoleum, took fright that it lay so near. Then he saw her, her face, small and boylike, peering through the shadowy recesses of the sumac that thronged about the foundation. She had seen it all, he realized. It shamed him for some reason.
Esme, no!
He cried. But it was too late. She had already leapt the foundations, had already started sprinting toward him across the browned and blackened turf. He saw it twinkle first, a flash in his periphery. Then the mark gouged nauseatingly deep. He looked up.
No!
He howled. Glass cracked beneath his feet. Long-winged, black scales about molten limbs, scimitar talons, an eye-encircled maw. A sifrang, called from the hellish bowels of the outside, a sulphurous godling. A gust swept up her skirts, knocked her to her knees. Esmanet turned her face skyward, a demon descending. Iacus. Proyas found himself on the roof of an ancient fullery, the only structure overlooking the Jutarum's westward approaches that wasn't aflame. Though sunlight ringed the distances, all was smoke and twilight. If he looked at the sky over long, he could feel himself spin, so he concentrated on the clay tiles beneath his feet. He scrambled across the shallow pitch, stumbled once, kicking free sheaves of rotted tile. He lowered himself onto his stomach,
crawled out onto a south-facing pediment, gazed across Shima. Streamers and veils of smoke lent the sky the perspective of city streets, making it easy to judge the relative distance of the hanging sorcerers and their warring lights. Below, all was black ruin and smoldering fire, freestanding walls as ragged as ripped parchment, guttered foundations, the wounded crying out, waving pale hands, the charcoal dead. Untouched on the heights, the first temple observed with monumental repose. There was a stupendous crack, and Proyas fairly toppled from his perch. He hugged the roof to the point of breathlessness, blinked the dazzle from his eyes. Almost immediately below him, he saw two crimson-robed schoolmen, one old and decrepit, surrounded by headless pillars in the gallery of a destroyed temple, the other, middle-aged and corpulent, balanced upon a crest of tossed debris. Their ward shone like silver in moonlight or steel in dark alleys. Mouths flaring, they sang and fires whooshed and thundered. Some 50 paces out, the ground exploded as if hammered by a rod the size of a great netia pine. Showers of smoking gravel rained across the wreckage. Somehow, impossibly, a figure cloaked in saffron floated through it. Blue incandescence surged from his forehead, plummeted over the ground, sweeping away pillars like sticks, breaking across the wards of the old scarlet schoolman. Proyas threw a forearm across his eyes, so bright was the contact. The Kishorum climbed skyward until he hung level with Proyas, flew out and around, all the while assailing the old sorcerer with gouts of blue-flashing energy. Black clouds had boiled into being in the air behind him, discharging lines of lightning like cracks in glass, but the Kishorum ignored them, intent on overcoming the scarlet schoolman below. The air hummed with crashing reverberations, the clacking of mountain-sized stones. Against this tumult, the screams of men could be no more than the chirps of infant mice, or nothing at all. Trailing thunder, fading light, the hanging figure had relented, turning both face and serpents to the other madly singing schoolman. His robes boiled a shimmering ochre in the wind. His asps fanned like iron hooks from about his neck. Proyas didn't have to look to know the old sorcerer was dead, or that the other soon would be. He found himself standing windswept on the pediment, perched on the very ledge, ruined streets and blasphemous fire careering across the distances before him. "Sweet God of gods," he cried to the acrid wind. With bare hands he tore the koray from the chain about his neck. "Who walk among us?" He drew back his sword-weary arm, secured his footing. "Innumerable are your holy names!" And he cast his tear of God, a gift from his mother, on his seventh birthday. It seemed to vanish against the iron horizon. Then a flash, a black-ringed circle of light, from which the saffron figure plummeted like a sodden flag. Proyas fell to his knees on the brink, leaned out over the fall. His holy city gaped before him, and he wept, though he knew not why. Again and again the thanes and knights of Satadon charged, but they could not staunch the breach. Soon they were engulfed in howling desert horsemen beset on all sides. In an endless stream, silk-garbed Kianin galloped beneath the arches and into view of the Enrethi encampment. Hundreds of them climbed the teetering pilings, gained the summit of the aqueduct, where pitched battles were waged beneath the withering fire of the heathen horse archers. Others charged the length of the stonework, into Earl Damergal and his hard-pressed Kuarwethi, trying to roll back the flanks of the breach. Still others beat their horses toward the stunned crowd of onlookers about the rim of the encampment. A shout was raised among the Nangales, where a spear took down King Pilaskanda and set his Girgashi reeling back in disorder. The mastodons, panicked in the withdrawal, began stomping through their own lines. The Ainani cheered Palatine Uranyanka, who rode along their lines holding high the severed head of Kinganjahoy, who had been trapped behind the Mozorothi after being driven back by Lord Soter and his Kishyati.
but the doom of the Enrithi rode with Fanael Abkaskamandri, who led his shimmering grandees far behind the lines of the idolaters. To the north and the south, cohorts of Kianin spread across the Sherazor plain, shrugging past clots of battling knights and hooking back to the east to charge into the far side of the ancient aqueduct. Earl Damergal was killed by a block thrown from the arches above. Earl Iyengar found himself stranded with his household to the rear of his Nangales. Howling oaths, he watched his kinsmen broken into warring clots. A Mongolian grandee silenced him with an arrow through the throat. Death came swirling down. The Fainim wept with fury, with outrage, as they cut down the Enrithi invaders. They cried out glory to Fain and the solitary god, even as they wondered that the men of the Tusk did not flee.
Think.
In Odaini concussion cant, knocking her clear of the thing's monstrous descent back toward the mausoleum. It landed hard and leaden, as though it had been wrought of twisted anchors, yet it moved as if its limbs floated in some unseen ether. The thing turned to him, hunched and slavering.
"The voice,"
it wheezed, taking one dread step forward. All life crumbled to tan dust about it.
"It says, an eye for an eye."
Waves of heat rolled outward, as dry as bone become ash.
"Then the hurting ends."
And Akamian knew this was no common demon. Its mark was like light, concentrated to the point where the parchment of the world blackened, curled, and burned. The Deimos! What had Iarchas loosed?
"Esme!"
he cried.
"Flee! Please, I beg you, flee!"
The thing leapt toward him. Akamian began singing, the deepest of the Koroi looms. Glorious abstractions knitted the air about him before him, a thresher of light. The demon laughed and screamed. His father staggered against the panels that pitted the walls. Snakes curled out of the recesses, shining in black. They curled about his throat, like eyes that strangled. Kellis stepped back, focused his eyes on a point the size of a thumbnail held at arm's length. What was one became many. What was soul became place. Here, calling out from bones of things. With three voices he sang, one utteral pitched to the world and two inutterals directed to the ground. What had been an ancient cant of calling became something far, far more, a cant of transposing. Blue fractal lights mapped the air about him, cocooned him in brilliance. Through scribbling filaments, he saw his father press himself upright, turn with his asps to the girded corridor, Anasarimber Moengus, that he could look so pale in the light of his sun. Existence cringed before the whip of his voice. Space cracked. Here was pride into there. Beyond his father he saw Serwe, her blonde hair tied into a war knot. He saw her leap out of the black, even as he toppled into one far greater. Drusus Akamian shouted out destruction. Light scored the creature, parabolas of knifing white. Molten blood flecked the grasses. Chits of fiery flesh sailed like kicked coals. Waves of heat burned Esmanet's cheeks. She stared as one transfixed, though she could not bear to watch. Surrounded by withered, burning grasses, he stood behind his sheets of light, at once glorious with power and dreadful with frailty. But the thing was upon him, a raving nightmare, hammering and clawing, blows that cracked the stone about her, that brought blood to her nose. Wards buckled and fractured. Akamian called out great concussions, and the demon's head was battered. Horns snapped. Spider eyes ruptured light. Its assault became a frenzy, a jerking blur of violence, until it seemed hell itself tore and gnashed at his gates. Akamian staggered, blinked white-burning eyes, cried out. An instant of wasted voice. Rats screamed through its exultant roar. Akamian falling, his mouth working, the closing of dragon claws. Akamian falling. She could not scream. the monstrosity leapt into the sky, punishing the air with rent wings. She could not scream.
I live!
Aikuri Confess cried one more time, only to hear nothing above the crack and thunder of sorcerous battle, both near and far. No resounding cheer, no individual shouts of relief or acclaim. They couldn't see him, that was it. They mistook him for one of their own, for a man. He whirled back to his stunned rescuers.
You!
He shouted to a dumbstruck Celio captain.
Find General Baxatis! Tell him to join me here at once.
The man hesitated, for scarcely an eye blink, but it sparked a cold fire in Confess's belly. Then the fool was off, sprinting through grass and clover toward distant formations.
And you,
Confess snapped at a run-of-the-mill columnary.
Find some hornsmen. Quick, quick! Tell them to signal the general advance. And you...
He broke off. There was shouting on the wind. Of course. It had just taken them time to recover their hearts, to gather their wits, the hapless fools. They thought me dead. Grinning, he turned back to the vista of his army, only to see the horsemen he had glimpsed earlier, several hundred of them, riding unchallenged along the stationary flanks of the Celial column.
There are no more nations!
A voice cried from their galloping midst.
There are no more nations!
For several moments, Confess could scarce credit his eyes, or even his ears, for that matter. They were obviously in Rethi, despite their white and blue calots. The banner of the Circumfix hung above the forward riders, trailing a skirt of golden tassels, and behind it, the Red Lion.
Kill them!
Confess howled.
Attack! Attack! Attack!
For an instant, it seemed nothing would happen, that nobody had heard. His army continued to mill in imbecile crowds. The interlopers continued to ride unmolested among them.
There are no more nations!
Then the white-clad knights abruptly changed direction, began riding toward him. Confess turned to the remaining columnaries, at once laughed and snarled, and he remembered his grandmother, back when her beauty had yet burned as bright as legend. He remembered her drawing him up onto her lap and laughing at the way he squirmed and kicked his legs.
It's good you prefer to keep your feet on the ground. For an emperor, that is the first thing.
And what is the second?
A laugh like a clear fountain.
Ah, the second is that you must ceaselessly measure.
Measure what, Grandmama?
He could remember tapping his fingers on her cheek. How small his fingernails had been.
The purses of those who serve you, my little godling, for if you ever find them empty...
Of the dozen Nansor columnaries who faced him, two fell to their knees, weeping, and three offered their swords. Five ran like madmen, and two simply walked away. He could hear the rumbling climb into the sky behind him.
I defeated the Skilvendi,
he said to the remainder.
You were there!
Hooves pounding the turf. The ground shivered through his sandals.
No man could do such a thing,
he said.
No man!
One of the kneelers cried. The soldier clutched his hand, kissed his imperial ring. Such a deep sound, the charge of the Enrithi. Thunder about horses snorting, gear clanking. So this was what the heathen heard. The emperor of Nansur turned, not really believing. He saw King Sauban leaning from his saddle, his face ruddy with murderous intent. More than sun glinted in the man's blue eyes. He saw the broadsword that took his head. Striding through smoke and over towering bonfires, Eleazarus advanced on the heresiarch of the Kishorim. Siokti ravaged the ground before him, raising up skirts of smoking debris, tossing and breaking the black-armored Thunieri that surged toward him. His voice bleeding, Eleazarus shouted out the most powerful of the great analogies. He was the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires, the greatest school of near antiquity. He was heir to Sampaleth, Firesinger, to Amreza the Black. He would avenge his beloved teacher, his school.
Sashioka!
He screamed between cants. Dragonfire buffeted the Heresiarch earthward.
and for a moment the man rolled in golden fire, sheathed in foaming blue, fouled in his shimmering yellow gowns. Again and again Eleazarus smote him. Magma burst from the earth beneath him. Suns crashed from the heavens. Great burning palms slapped about his alien defenses, a fiery crush into which Eleazarus sang more and more power, until he saw the blind face cry out. His feet braced across smoke and sky, Eleazarus laughed as he sang, for vengeance had made hatred a thing of rapture and glory. But from a different direction, flurries of blue plasma, the holy water of the Indara Kishari, rained across his wards, rocking them, then glancing off into the clouds above, where they vanished in smudges of glowing blue. The ghosts of cracks appeared. Sheets of ethereal stone fell away. Another Inkandati, soaring up from the ruin, disgorging world-cracking power. Eleazarus turned back to his wards, singing deeper ramparts, sturdier shields. He glimpsed Siakti, climbing back into the sky, glaring cataracts flaring from an impossible point between his missing eyes. Where were his brother schoolmen? Taramis, Tai? All about him the world had become a tidal surge of brilliant white and blue, tearing, pounding, markless, as virginal as the god-spun world. Tearing, pounding. The Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires grunted, cursed. Jets of incandescence exploded through his wards, immolating his left arm even as he screamed deeper defenses. A fissure opened before him. Light blew across his scalp and brow. Like a doll, he was thrown backward. His corpse toppled into the burning tracts below. All along the length of the Skellura Aqueduct, the Phanum enveloped the despairing men of the Tusk. Horsemen swept in flurries about the pilings, loosing shafts from point-blank range. Others charged into haphazard shield walls, hacking their way past pikes and spears. Lord Galgota, the Palatine of Eshkenax, fell to the merciless fervor of the Kurgwi. Lord Gotian charged into the fray with all that remained of his Shrial knights. At first, their conviction and fury won them long expanses of ground, but they were too few. The heathen swarmed about their flanks, shot their horses out from under them. The knights of the Tusk fought on, singing hymns that no calamity could break. Gotian fell, struck by an arrow in his armpit as he held his sword high, and still the warrior monks sang, until death came swirling down. Then horns sounded from the west. For a moment, all those across the Sherazor, heathen and idolater alike, turned to the heights where the ancient Amati had buried their kings. And there, above the encampment, they saw the imperial army assembled in long lines along the crest. The men of the Tusk boomed in jubilation. At first, the heathen raised ragged cheers of their own and jeered at the arm waving in Rithi, for the grandees had told them not to fear should the Nansur arrive. But a presentiment of doom was traded among them, passing from band to slowing band. More than a few had seen the circumfix and the red lion among the sacred standards of the Nansur columns. This wasn't the treachery of an emperor, an Ikuri, come to seal a pact with their Padiraja. The hated standard of the Exalt General, with its distinctive Kyranian disc, was nowhere to be seen. No, this wasn't Ikuri Confis. It was the blonde beast, King Sauban. The Kianine horsemen withdrew from the surviving clots of Enrithi, milled in confusion across the plain. Even the golden Padiraja seemed uncertain. From the shadow of the aqueduct, Lord Werigin Greatheart cried out to the Tidoni of Pleidiol. Raising a great shout, the blonde-bearded warriors charged across the corpse-strewn turf, ran hacking into their wicked enemies' midst. Others followed, heedless of wounds or numbers. Black-robed schoolmen stood astride the sky. The imperial sake, the sorcerers of the sun, advancing on the massed formations of their hated ancestral foe. Horse and man thrashed black in descending fire. The Skilvendi fairly gagged for breath. There he was,
slumped against the mad walls of this place, in a white illuminated chamber that opened at the end of the corridor. Pale, naked, save a loincloth.
There he was.
For hours Nayur had climbed through these obscene halls, following Serwe and her brother as they tracked Kellis's scent. Apart from the braziers beneath the cavernous waterfall, all had been black. Deep into deep, dark into dark, through an underworld of vile images. They passed through ruins, Serwe said, the mines of Kunoroi, long murdered by the ancestors of men. And Nayur had known that no track could lead him farther from the steppe. His heart had hammered in his ears. He had glimpsed his father, Sciotha, beckoning through the black, and now, there he was, Moengus. Serwe assailed him first, her limbs and blade a whirring blur. But he stopped her with blue flashing hands, swatted aside her slender figure. Just as her brother descended, slashing at impossible palms, spinning and kicking, lunging and probing, only to be seized about the throat, to gape and thrash as the blind man lifted him off his feet, to blister and burn as blue light consumed his head, made a candle of his body. The thing's face cramped open, and the blind man threw him slack to the ground. Throughout this, Nayur had advanced down the corridor, walking steadily, though the numbness of his gait made it seem that he shambled. He remembered approaching Kellis the same way. That day he'd found him half-dead upon his father's barrow, surrounded by circles of lifeless rank. He remembered the limb-hollowing air of nightmares, the breath like needles. But this was different. That had been the point of departure from his homeland, from his people, from everything he had thought hallowed and strong. This was his destination. This was him. Him. Three black snakes coiled about his throat, one hooked above either shoulder, another curled above his gleaming scalp. Nayur glimpsed the wound in his abdomen, the blood soaking pink across his loincloth, but he couldn't recall seeing him cut. Nayur, the blind face said in recognition. Kellis's voice, Kellis's features. When had the son become the father's mold? Nayur, you have returned to me. The snakes watched him, their tongues lapping the air. Even without eyes, the face beseeched him, tugged with a look of long remorse and astonished joy. Just as I knew you would. Nayur stopped at the threshold, mere paces from the man who had butchered his heart. He glanced uneasily about the room, saw Serwe splayed motionless to his right, her long blonde hair swept across a bloodied floor, and the captive skin spies hanging abject within a curtain of pulleys and chains. The walls warred with inhuman images. He squinted at the light that hung impossibly beneath the graven vaults. Nayu, put down your sword, please. Blinking, he saw the notched blade in the air before him, though he had no recollection of drawing it. The light rolled like liquid across it.
I am Nayur Ur-Sciotha, he said. The most violent of all men.
No, Moenga said softly. That is but a lie that you use to conceal your weakness from other men, just as weak.
It is you who lie.
But I see it within you. I see the truth of you. I see your love.
I hate!
He screamed, so loud that the halls returned the words to them as a thousand whispers. Though blind, Moengus somehow managed to look to the ground in pensive pity. So many years, he said. So many seasons. Everything I showed you has scarred your heart, set you apart from the people. Now you hold me accountable for what I taught.
Desecration! Deceit!
Spittle burned his unshaven chin. Then why does it torment you so? Surely lies, when uncovered, fade like smoke. It is truth that burns, Nayu, as you know, for you have burned in it for uncounted seasons. Suddenly Nayur could feel it. The miles of earth heaped above them, the clawing inversion of ground. He had come too far. He had crawled too deep. The sword dropped from the stranger's senseless fingers, rang like something pathetic across the floor. His face broke, like a thing wrapped about twitching vermin. The sobs whispered across the pitted stone. And Mwengis was holding him, enclosing him, healing his innumerable scars. Nayu. He loved him, this man who had shown him, who had led onto the trackless steppe. I am dying, Nayu. Hot whispers in his ear. I need your strength. Abandoned him, forsook. He had loved only him in all the world. Weeping faggot. The kiss was deep, the smell strong, his heart hammered. Shame bled from his every pore, skittered across his trembling limbs, and somehow ignited an even deeper ardor. He breathed shuddering air into Mwengis's hot mouth. The snakes twisted through his hair, pressed hard and phallic against his temples. Nayur groaned. So unlike Serwe or Inissi. A wrestler's clasp, firm and unyielding, the promise of surrender, of shelter in stronger arms. He reached beneath his girdle, into his breeches. His eyes leaden with ardor, he murmured, I wander trackless ground. Mwengis gasped, jerked, and spasmed as Nayur rolled the kore across his cheek. White light flared from his gouged sockets. For an instant, Nayur thought, it seemed the god watched him through a man's skull. What do you see? But then his lover fell away, burning as he must, such was the force of what had possessed them.
Not again!
Nayur howled at the sagging form. He stumbled to his knees, weeping, raving.
How could you leave me?
His screech pealed through the derelict halls, filled the very earth, and he laughed, thinking of the final Swazond he would cut into his throat. One last thought too many.
See! See!
He cackled with grief. He knelt over his lover's corpse, for how many heartbeats he would never know. Then, just as the sorcerous light began to fade, a cool hand fell upon his cheek. He turned and saw Serwe. For an instant her face cracked, as though gasping for air, but then it was seamless once again, seamless and perfect. Yes, Serwe, the first wife of his heart, his proof and prize. Absolute darkness engulfed them. The walls of flame that fenced the great swath of destruction wrought by the scarlet spires crawled outward, leaving smoking husks in their wake. But somehow, miraculously, the ancient fullery, with its open galleries and queued basins, had escaped unscathed. Kneeling on the lip of its southern pediment, Proyas had seen it all, as though from the edge of a mighty cliff, the destruction of the scarlet spires. The drums of the heathen had replaced the unearthly thrum of incantations. Even now, the last of the Kisharim, he could see only five, floated over the charred and derelict landscape, the asps about their necks hooked downward, searching for survivors. Every several heartbeats, brilliance fell from them and crackling booms rifled through the darkling sky. He knew not what it meant. He knew nothing, save that this was Shaima. He turned his face skyward. Through the haze he glimpsed the first vestiges of blue, a rim of gold about fleecy black. There was a flash, a sparkle in the corner of his eye. He looked to the sacred heights, saw a point of light hanging above the eaves of the first temple. The point lingered, painting the slate shingles of the dome white. Then it burst, so bright that it struck circles across the firmament. Like sails cut from the mast, great sheets of smoke bloomed outward, swept over the hanging Kisharim and out across the devastation.
and Proyas saw a figure standing where the light had been, so distant he could scarce make out his features, save that his hair was gold and his gown billowed white. Kellis, the warrior prophet. Proyas blinked. Shivers splashed across his skin. The figure leapt from the temple's edge, soared over the astonished Phanum manning the Heterene wall, then down the slopes through the rim of burning buildings. Even from so far, Proyas could hear his world-reaming song. As one, the scattered Kishorim turned. With eyes like twin nails of heaven, the warrior prophet walked across the heights toward them. With every step, it seemed, debris flew from the ground toward him, where it was drawn into circling loops, one after another, smaller circles bisecting the orbits of those larger, until rings of spinning ruin fairly obscured him. The sun burst forth as after the deluge. Mountainous shafts of white pillared the streetscape, made pearl of the fallen, burnished the plumes that still piled black and gray into the sky. And Proyas saw the reason for the rings, heathen bowmen scrounging the ruin for Koray. The warrior prophet cried out, and sequential explosions fanned across the ground beneath him, making missiles of snapping stone and brick. Even still, Proyas glimpsed bolts rising toward him. Some sailed wide, others glanced from the rings, cracking the sorceries that bound them, flinging debris across the city. More and more ground-raking explosions. Bodies were tossed, foundations shattered. The thunder of it silenced the relentless throbbing of the drums. Soaring over the haze, their saffron robes flashing in the sunlight, the five Kishorim closed with Kellis. Like cataracts of water, blinding energies crashed across his spherical wards, burning with a brilliance that forced Proyas to throw up a hand against the glare. Somehow, perfect lines flickered from the maelstrom, coiled into knifing geometries about the nearest of the Kishorim. The blind man seemed to claw the air with his hands, then rained across the ground in blood and pieces. But Kellis's wards were failing, cracked and shattered by tempests of unholy light. No more Gnostic lines glittered out to assail the hanging Kishorim, and Proyas realized that Kellis could not win, that he could only cry out wards lest he be swept away, that it was only a matter of time. Then, impossibly, it was over. The Kishorim relented, and the roar of their assault trailed away like distant thunder. Proyas could see nothing, only smoke, ruin, and sunlight. He found himself gaping for breath, or was it a soundless howl? Sweet God! Sweet God of gods! There was a flash behind one of the assailants, and suddenly Kellis was there, a hand clamped about the Kishorim's jaw, and Shoya's blade jutting bright through the saffron across his breast. Proyas stumbled to his feet, nearly teetered in a fatal fall. He caught himself, laughed through his tears, cried out. Then Kellis was gone, and the body dropped. The three remaining Kishorim hung motionless, dumbstruck. Had they eyes, Proyas was certain they would have blinked. And the warrior prophet was behind another, beheading him, halving his snakes, in the space of a heartbeat. Proyas saw Kellis jerk as the body tumbled down, realized he had caught a crossbow bolt fired from below. In a single snapping motion, he threw it like a knife at the nearest sorcerer priest. There was a burst of incandescence rimmed by a nacre of black. The figure dropped. Proyas whooped. Never had he felt so renewed, so young. And Anassarimber Kellis was singing the abstractions once again. White robes boiled in the clearing sun. Planes and parabolas crackled about him. The very ground, to the pith of its ruin, hummed. The surviving Kishorim floated in a broad and wary circle. He knew he had to keep moving, Proyas realized, to avoid the fate of his brothers. But it was already far too late. There was no escaping the warrior prophet's holy light. The sun slipped red into the iron west. The clouds crumbled in the southern winds, and were dragged into purple streamers over the Menenor. The gloom reared from the gullies and ravines of the devastation. Blood cooled across pitted stone. In the dying light, something clink-clinked over the wheezing of subterranean fires. Amid stone heaped and tossed about unmoving foundations, a small boy hunched over a shattered figure of white, using a stone to chip salt into the palm of his little hand. Though the battle was over, he cast terrified looks over his shoulder. When he had filled his purse, he turned to the dead sorcerer's face, regarded it with an eerie blankness that a grown man might have confused with sorrow, but his mother, had she still breathed, would have known as hope. He stood, bent to study a small cut on his knee. He smeared the blood away with his thumb, watched a new bead well in its place. Then, spooked by some sound, he whirled and saw the strange human-headed bird that regarded him.
"Would you like to know a secret?"
a thin voice cooed. The miniature face grinned, as though finding unexpected pleasure in playing a half-hearted game. Too numb to be terrified, the young boy nodded, clutched tight the salt that would be his fortune.
"Come closer,"